TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Naomi Klein on Coronavirus Capitalism. An interview by Mehdi Hassan for The Intercept. In addition to being a world-renowned author, Naomi Klein is also a senior correspondent at the investigative news organization The Intercept. She posted on TheIntercept.com in March 2020, quote, "During moments of cataclysmic change, the previously unthinkable suddenly becomes reality. In recent decades, that change has mainly been for the worst, but this has not always been the case, and it need not continue to be in the future," end quote. Naomi Klein's colleague and friend, Mehdi Hassan, is a senior columnist at The Intercept. You will now hear excerpts from his interview with her, originally streamed live on April 7, 2020. Here's Mehdi Hassan and his introduction of Naomi Klein.
Welcome to another live broadcast from The Intercept. I'm Mehdi Hassan, coming to you live from my home. The US economy is still effectively shut down. More than 10 million people filed for unemployment in the last 2 weeks of March alone. And while big businesses are getting bailed out, basically with no questions asked by the federal government, small businesses are still struggling to get their loans that they were promised. And ordinary Americans are waiting for a miserly $1,200 one-time payment from the Treasury. So who better to discuss this all with than my legendary colleague and good friend, Naomi Klein, senior correspondent at The Internet, chair of media, culture, and feminist studies at Rutgers, and author most recently of On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, as well as classics such as The Shock Doctrine and No Logo. Naomi, thanks for joining us. Naomi, before we get going and get into the deep stuff, let me just ask you a personal question. How are you handling your own lockdown?
It's a complicated question. We were exposed to the virus pretty early on. A friend and colleague who stayed at our house got sick and then went back to Canada. And because Canada is more of a functioning state than the United States, was able to get a test and tested positive. And my husband, Avi Lewis, and I both have had symptoms, mild symptoms. But despite being exposed to the virus, we weren't able to get a test. So I just share this because it's an example of the fact that what Trump is saying daily, that there are tests and that people who are known to be exposed, have been exposed, can get a test. In our experience, that's a lie. My doctor wasn't able to get me a test. And we're feeling better and feeling very grateful. And I teach at Rutgers, as you mentioned. I'm teaching by Zoom, but teaching undergraduates whose lives have been turned absolutely upside down and inside out. Almost every one of my students has lost a job that was helping pay for their education. Many of their parents have lost jobs. And they're worried about graduating into a depression, certainly a recession. And I'm also homeschooling my seven-year-old. So, yes. Of course, with a lot of help from my husband. So, yeah, I wouldn't say things are normal. How about you?
That has been a challenge. Yeah. The homeschooling definitely has been a challenge. One of my kids said to me today, I don't have to do any homeschooling. It's spring break.
I'm totally buying into that next week is spring break and we don't have to homeschool.
Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, we should add this, obviously, we are the lucky ones. People are in much worse positions than us. And this crisis has really exposed a lot of things wrong with the society that we're in that we're going to discuss now. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to kick off with is talking about disaster capitalism, what you became famous for writing about over the years. You wrote that classic book, The Shock Doctrine, I think in 2007. As you look at the lie of the land, as you look at what's going on in Washington, D.C., across the country, across the world, where are we seeing disaster capitalism rear its ugly head, or where will we see it rear its ugly head in the coming months and years?
Just to sort of define terms a little bit. When I started using this phrase, the shock doctrine, as opposed to disaster capitalism, which really just means kind of profiteering from disasters, taking advantage of a disaster to make money in large part by privatizing the response to the disaster. So we're seeing lots of examples of disaster capitalism in the way Trump is trying to run the response to the pandemic as this you know, straight out of Mar-a-Lago public-private partnership, right, where he has been very reluctant to use executive powers to force corporations to make necessary materials, but he has really liked the idea of sort of corporations voluntarily stepping up. He's turned his briefings into an advertisement for a lot of American companies. So that is what, you know, one of the things that I mean by disaster capitalism. The shock doctrine is different. It is the political tactic of using states of crisis, states of emergency, to push through a series of pro-corporate policies that leave us more divided, less protected. And we're certainly seeing this in the midst of the pandemic. Some examples I would point to are the fact that fossil fuel companies are getting their wish list of policies.
Okay. I found this on the web.
For some reason, Siri is very, very active these days. I never used to have this problem. All right, let me just deal with this because that'll just keep happening. But yeah, so whatever fossil fuel companies were after before this crisis set in, they have just been checking off the wish list, right? So ramming through the Keystone XL pipeline, for instance, and this has been a group effort from Canadians, particularly in Alberta, the Canadian government, and the Alberta government that has directly subsidized the pipeline in the midst of the pandemic. And then state governments in the United States, where this is a pipeline that would go from Alberta, Canada to the Gulf Coast, been one of the most controversial projects in the US. Thousands of people were arrested, including me, trying to stop it. And they haven't been able to get it, get construction going, in part because people have been willing to engage in civil disobedience to stop it. Now, when people are in their homes, several states have passed laws that make it a felony to disrupt what they call critical infrastructure, including fossil fuel projects. Of course, the irony of this is that we have a massive glut of oil, and this is by no means an essential project that is needed in order to keep the lights on in the United States. It's just straight up opportunism. The EPA is suspending enforcement of all kinds of environmental regulations in the midst of the pandemic. It's not just the United States that's doing this. China has also announced that to get their economy up and running after the pandemic, they are not going to be enforcing their environmental regulations. That's just one example of the shock doctrine in the midst of the pandemic. But you know, one of the things I'm particularly worried about is what happens after. You know, if we think about the last time the global economy melted down, it expressed itself through all, you know, brutal austerity around the world. And so what happens when the corporate bailouts that we're seeing in this moment, the bill for that sort of comes due and it expresses itself as a war on public education, further war on public health care. This is what I think we need to be really wary about. We're already seeing Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, use the pandemic as an excuse to potentially not enforce rules that require schools to provide equal access to children with disabilities. So whatever the policy that's been lying around there, they're going for it.
Indeed, that is the phrase, the one that's lying around. That's how the right have always responded to crisis over the decades, is to see it as an opportunity to ram things through, as you say. Just over the past 24 hours, the president of the United States removed the chairman of the federal panel that Congress set up to oversee his administration's implementation of the $2 trillion stimulus package. Democrats are now up in arms, complaining, you know, saying this is wrong, this is bad. But, you know, did congressional Democrats really think that Trump would abide by the terms of any legislative deal they struck with Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in Congress?
Right. I mean, there were a few strings attached to this cascade of money that has been unleashed for corporate America. And as soon as the bill was passed, the Trump administration just set out to snip all of those strings. And we're seeing another
example. Which we knew they would.
Which we knew they would. Yeah. And I think it's important because this is not the last stimulus bill or bailout bill or whatever you want to call it that is going to be before Congress. You know, I think what we need to recognize, and this is something that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was saying from the beginning, is that basically the battle was lost when the corporate bailout was bundled together with the rescue package for people, right? The relief for people, for the millions and millions of Americans who are losing their jobs, who can't pay the rent, who can't pay their utilities. People are desperate for rescue. And by bundling together the meager rescue, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, you know, crumbs for the people, and this avalanche of money for corporations. When they were bundled together, all was lost, because no politician is going to vote against that much needed emergency money for their constituencies. And so what I think we need to be really grilling Democratic lawmakers on is whether or not they're going to prevent the bundling next time. And we have to be really, really clear that many of these Democrats wanted it to be bundled because they are also under pressure from corporations to give them these bailouts.
There is a sense of kind of, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Mm. And a sense of how many times are they going to make excuses? Oh, we didn't know they would do this. We can't believe how amoral and cynical they are. Come on, at this point, they should be aware of what's going on. And same with the corporations, as you mentioned. Talk to me about how the fossil fuel industry has taken advantage of this quote unquote stimulus bill, how they've come forward from the very beginning. And you had the aviation industry, one of the first industries to line up asking for a bailout, even though I think they spent 96% of their spare cash over the last decade on share buybacks.
Right, right. Yeah, there's a website that people can check out that I tweeted out earlier today. It's
called drillednews.com.
I think I saw you tweet. Yeah, I mean, it's there. You can look at a running tally of all of these policy grabs that the fossil fuel industry has been engaged in. Well, I mentioned a couple of them already, basically suspending the enforcement of EPA rules, automobile controls that were introduced under Obama, emission controls. And I want to focus there. This is really, really significant, because one of the things that we're seeing right now is that in the United States, this pandemic is not equally lethal. Yes. There is a disproportionate number of African Americans who are dying right now. And so it isn't clear that, at least I haven't seen the data yet that shows that more African Americans are contracting the virus. But of course, we don't really know because we don't have testing, coming back to what we were talking about.
Well, the New York Times, just on the numbers, the New York Times has a piece out today which points out that in Chicago, 1 in 3 residents are African Americans, but 50% of people there who have tested positive for COVID-19 are African American. In Louisiana, it's even worse, where 70% of the deaths have been Black Americans in Louisiana, even though Black people make up only a third of that state's population. So the numbers look pretty dire, and there's a huge discrepancy.
The mortality rates among African Americans are absolutely staggering. And so what we know about this virus is that it is more lethal for people whose immune systems are already weakened, right? So that's why it's more lethal for elderly people, but it's also more lethal for people who have these pre-existing conditions, particularly respiratory conditions, but also hypertension. So these are illnesses that are already unevenly distributed in the United States. Part of the reason is because African Americans have more stressful lives, because they have more stressful jobs or multiple stressful jobs. But also because pollution is unevenly distributed in the United States because of environmental racism. And so this is an added irony to the fact that the fossil fuel companies are getting their wish list fulfilled in the midst of this pandemic and rolling back all of these controls on air pollution and water pollution and every kind of pollution.
And we're seeing the counties with even slightly higher levels of air pollution have higher cases of COVID-19.
Exactly.
So you're pointing out the double whammy here, is that they've caused these pre-existing problems, to borrow a phrase, and then they're also getting bigger bailouts than the people who are suffering from it. Of course, you mentioned kind of African-American population. Two of the other major issues is, number one, they're more likely to be uninsured, which is a problem specific to the US, not to Canada, where you're from, or the UK, where I'm from. And of course, they tend to be doing the jobs that still are being done in this crisis. If you go outside, if you are fortunate to go out, go grocery shopping, go to a pharmacy, most of the people who are still working, unfortunately, don't have the luxury of working from home, are Black and Latino populations.
Right. And that's also who's inside Amazon warehouses. It's also who's delivering packages. There's some evidence that increased viral load, i.e. if you're repeatedly exposed, increases the mortality rate.
So as much as people say, even liberals, with the best of intentions, this is a disease that shows we're all in this together, we're not quite all in this together.
know, we're not all in this together, because it's playing out in very, very different ways in terms of, you know, who has the luxury to self-isolate, right? Who has the luxury to self-isolate, in palatial residence, with staff and childcare, et cetera, right? And who's juggling, who's working from home and who has kids, and who is out there working harder than they've ever worked before in these essential roles, whether in healthcare, or picking food.
And risking their lives.
Yeah, and risking their lives.
One of the most annoying things I see is people say, these people are heroes. And yeah, they are heroes, but on the other hand, they don't want to be heroes. They just want to have decent healthcare and masks and equipment. They shouldn't have to be heroes or martyrs. They should be able to do their job with proper equipment, resources, hazard pay, sick pay, and the rest of things that we should take for granted.
You are listening to excerpts from a live interview of Naomi Klein by Mehdi Hassan, first published on the investigative news site The Intercept on April 7, 2020.
You know, I do think that these workers, many of them are feeling their power in a way that they had not previously. And there is a realization that they are indeed essential workers, yeah. And they have been treated systematically in ways designed to belittle the value of their labor. Hmm. And we are seeing work stoppages across the economy, and I think we'll probably see more of those. So, I have written about disaster capitalism in the past. We may well see some disaster unionism in the midst of this pandemic as workers organize and flex their collective muscle.
I mean, it'll be fascinating to see in the aftermath of this crisis, and that can't come too soon in my view, what moments there are to go to the right or the left. Take immigration. Yeah. You have undocumented workers being treated as essential workers too. So essential, but they can't have citizenship.
Right.
So I think that all of these debates are going to play out. One of those debates is going to be the debate about government involvement in the economy. Yes. Socialism, the S word, is a scary word here in the United States. You mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. When AOC was on my podcast a couple of weeks ago at the start of the crisis, she made the point that there's always been socialism in America. It's socialism for the rich, the MLK line. And you're seeing that very much so now in the reaction to this crisis when you have, for example, Donald Trump says, I can't force companies via the Defense Production Act. We shouldn't interfere in the free enterprise system and mm-hmm. force companies like they do in Venezuela to make stuff. And yet when the same companies are in trouble, they're asking for bailouts. The government doesn't say, no, thanks, you're on your own. It's called free enterprise.
Right, right. But so I think that things are going to change. I mean, this is something that we need to understand. Arundhati Roy, in her piece in the Financial Times a couple of days ago, talked about the virus as a portal. And the question facing all of us is what are we going to carry through to this new place? Because the future that we are going towards is not the same as the past. Now, that future could be worse, and indeed left to its own devices. Our system will produce a more divided, more xenophobic and racist society than the one we have now. And we are already seeing all of these attempts to blame the virus on immigrants, to blame the virus on the Chinese, to deflect blame, obviously, from the leaders who failed to prepare on every front and are causing this carnage in this very moment. Or we can heed the messages of this moment, whether it is the essential nature of care work, of the fact that the people who feed us, picking the food that we eat, preparing it, serving it, delivery, deserve to be paid a living wage and only have one job rather than three. So many people who work in the restaurant sector live off of tips. They need to be paid a living wage. And so there are all kinds of organizations that are working on this and also working to show that this is not the only crisis that we face. I mean, what we're talking about here is the fact that a disaster like this, like every other disaster, doesn't play out equally. It exacerbates pre-existing inequalities. It follows the fault lines of pre-existing injustices. This is true of hurricanes. This is true of wildfires. And it is true of this pandemic as well.
And it's also true of the financial crisis in 2008. The problem is after the financial crisis, as you mentioned a moment ago, the world went right, not left. There was right-wing populism, not left-wing populism. There was brutal austerity after there were bailouts for big banks. Are you confident that we won't go right again after this crisis, that we might go left?
Oh, I'm not confident about it at all.
You sounded confident a moment ago, and I wanted you to fill us all with
hope and
optimism.
What I'm saying is that it is a choice. You know, our system left to its own devices will exploit this crisis to deliver a much less equal society than we have right now. It absolutely will try to impose austerity to pay for the corporate bailouts that we're seeing right now. The reason why I have hope, which is different, I think, than being hopeful, the reason why I have hope is because I do think that we're seeing some amazing organizing among very underpaid yet crucial, crucial actors in our economy. And I think that we need to be thinking about how we support and amplify those workers in this moment. We also need to recognize that we live in a time of overlapping and intersecting crises, and there is the climate crisis. And so one of the things that we're seeing right now is what is possible when you actually recognize that you are in an emergency. You know, Greta Thunberg now for almost 2 years has been imploring world leaders to treat the climate crisis as if it is an emergency. And people have been patting her on the head and passing meaningless resolutions saying, oh, yes, it's a climate emergency, and then going on as if nothing has changed. But what we are all seeing right now is actually, if you really do recognize that something is an emergency, you can do all kinds of things, right?
Yes. The idea that crises are opportunities should also work for progressives, not just for disaster capitalists. One of the things we've seen during this crisis, Naomi, is people doubting the science. Doubting the experts, doubting the doctors and epidemiologists, especially on the right, especially in the name of protecting the economy. And I guess it's exactly what happened over the years with climate change and the science on climate change and the existential threat it poses to all of us, the same manufacturing of doubt.
Right. And indeed, many of the same people who get cast out on the reality of human-caused climate change are the very ones who have been quickest to spread conspiracy theories about.
And Donald Trump used the same word, hoax, for climate change that he used for this disease at the start of it.
And it goes further back because some of these are the same think tanks and the same very same scientists who denied there was a link between smoking and cancer. Indeed. I mean, this is a long tradition. So sure, we're seeing that, right? And we're seeing all kinds of crazy stuff, right? I saw a clip of somebody who'd gone to church and believed that she was being protected from the pandemic because she was now bathed in the blood of Christ.
Yes,
so, yeah. But I would say one of the things that we're seeing at the same time is a greater appreciation for the scientists, a greater desire to see policymakers, to see politicians take their cues from scientists and not just make up policy based on what is politically expedient for them. And so I think a lot of this should guide our recovery, right? These core principles should guide the way we emerge out of this crisis. And certainly there are precedents for moments of deep crisis, of deep trauma, leading to progressive change in society. You're from the UK, you know that the NHS was born in the aftermath of the Second World War, and a feeling that after people had sacrificed so much, lost so much during the war, that there had to be a peace dividend, and that peace dividend was universal public health care. This is not something that was just delivered from on high. It was something that was demanded from below. As you know, I've been involved in the effort for a Green New Deal in the United States. And that effort is modeled off of the original New Deal during the 1930s, during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. It takes inspiration from the scale of that economic stimulus, but also it's informed by many of the failures and exclusions of the original New Deal. So we have precedents on the right and the left. When I published my last book, On Fire, in September, you know, the pushback I often heard was that it was too much. It was too fast. You know, it's too ambitious. Why is there so much in there? My response was, look, America has done this before, and pointed to the original New Deal and the World War II mobilizations. What people said to me in response was, but the fact is, there isn't really precedent for that kind of ambitious intervention when there isn't an economic crisis. So I actually do think that the conditions for a Green New Deal are in some ways much better than they were before, because it is, after all, a stimulus. It's modeled after the greatest economic stimulus of all time.
And last question then on a voting related note, you have this ridiculous, dangerous election in Wisconsin today, which the Democratic governor tried to postpone there, but which the state Supreme Court and the US Supreme Court both overrode. Aren't we seeing a preview of the presidential election here? The Republicans wanting low turnout at all costs. They don't care if Americans have to risk their lives to go out and vote in the middle of a pandemic, but they won't allow new postal voting or absentee voting or early voting measures that could prevent people risking their lives in order to go out and cast a ballot. Shouldn't Democrats make this a non-negotiable part of the next stimulus bill, fixing the electoral system?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And this needs to be a moment to be shaming, outing and shaming the fact that the Republican Party is being so completely transparent that they cannot win when there is high voter turnout, that they are bound and determined to suppress voters because a high voter turnout and their hold on power are simply incompatible. And now they are willing to sacrifice their own voters in order to hold on to power. And it's one of the ugliest things I have ever seen. And I think the Democrats need to go so hard exposing it that it becomes untenable for the Republicans to continue to resist voting by mail. Because if we don't have these safe options, then we can absolutely count on Trump to use this pandemic to try to do all manner of anti-democratic power grabs, the likes of which we are already seeing from Netanyahu, Viktor Orban, all these guys who he is big fans of around the world.
And of course, the Republican Party has long known that more democracy is bad for them. And Trump recently, I think in a Fox News interview, said, if the Democrats get all these measures passed, you'll never get a Republican elected again, which is classic Trump saying the quiet part loud. Naomi, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about all these horrific issues. I hope that you're right, that this is an opportunity, and I hope that the opportunity is for the left and not the right.
That was Mehdi Hasan from The Intercept, signing off from his interview with the author and Intercept colleague, Naomi Klein. You can see the full interview on the Intercept.com website or on YouTube. Search for Naomi Klein on coronavirus capitalism. Mehdi Hasan is a British journalist, broadcaster, author, and a senior columnist at The Intercept. Naomi Klein is a Canadian author, social activist, and filmmaker. Among her books are This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics, and Winning the World We Need, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalists, and On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.